We're happy to make podcasts available for selected EdWebinars for your listening pleasure. If you'd like to receive a CE certificate, you must watch the video recording. Recordings and quizzes can be found in the EdWebinar archives. Please visit home.edweb.net/podcasts for more information.
My name is Christy Shelley, and I am the Chief Product Officer at Core Learning. I want to welcome and thank you for joining us for this exciting conversation today. We're going to get started with our webinar, Valuing English Varieties, Understanding Language Diversity and Its Relationship to Structured Literacy with Dr. Brandi Gatlin-Nash. I would like to first introduce our moderator. Our moderator today is Maya. Say hi, Maya. Maya Valencia Goodall, who is a pioneering force in education, driven by a singular mission to ensure that every student, regardless of their linguistic background, receives the literacy and language instruction they both need and deserve. She continues to shape the educational landscape as one of the leaders in the design and enhancement of OLA, the Online Language and Literacy Academy at Core Learning. Maya's legacy is a testament to her extraordinary commitment to educational excellence. And you will hear a lot from Maya today as her and Brandi walk through this conversation today. Today, Core is our sponsor for this week of events. So for 27 years, Core has championed the science of reading. Some people refer to them as the originals of science of reading and professional development. Take a moment to read the description of what we do and who we are. Our advisory board members over the years have included icons in the research of science of reading, including Joe Torgensen, Barbara Foreman, Isabel Beck, Ed Kamianui, David Chard, Louisa Motes, Mark Shin, Phyllis Hunter, Elsa Cardenas-Hagen, Claude Goldenberg, and our very own Brandi Gatlin-Nash, who is here today with us. I'm going to give you a little bio on Brandi. Feel free to read through that as I give a nice summary, and then I'm going to turn it over. Dr. Brandi Gatlin-Nash is an associate professor in the School of Education at the University of California, Irvine, where her passion for education and innovation shines. Her research leads the exploration of the complex relationship between language and literacy in culturally and linguistically diverse students. You are in for an amazing hour. I can't wait to learn, so I'm going to hand it over to Maya.
Thank you so much, Christy. Yes, we are so excited. We have been talking this week about structured literacy in the language diverse classroom. And today we're going to delve into the world of English language variety and make some comparisons to multilingual learners. We know that English varieties are full and complete languages with their own grammar rules. We know that standard English is a language variety and that some students come to school to learn this variety of English. So let's get started. So the first question, Brandi, to you is just to orient us around some of the verbiage that we hear regarding English language varieties. What is the difference between dialect, vernacular, and language variety?
All right. So first of all, Maya, I want to thank you all for having me here today. Just to be mentioned in the same room as Elsa Cardenas-Hagen and Claude Goldenberg, to be on this panel and to be speaking is such a huge honor. So first of all, thank you for that. And I'm really excited to talk about just something that I'm really passionate about. And yeah, let's just get started. So the difference between dialect, vernacular, and language variety. So I want you all, before I even get into that, I want you to think about, and you, Maya, think about this. Think about your favorite movie or a TV show from the 70s or the 80s, the 90s, maybe even the early 2000s. Think about the language that was used, or maybe even a topic that was on that show or that movie. You ever watch it and you think, oh, they couldn't get away with that now. They couldn't get away with saying that now. That's so offensive. So think about the fact that language is always changing. Language is always evolving. The things that we said years ago and the words that we used, a lot of times we realize that they're inappropriate, they're offensive. So we think of new terminology to explain what we're talking about. So I want to get into linguistic diversity and what we call certain things. So on the left, I have often what we think of as standard English. You have correct English, proper English, standard. Sometimes we throw in the word American English, academic English, mainstream American English, white mainstream English, formal English, school English, general American English, and what I like to refer to as standardized American English. And the reason I refer to it as standardized English is because I like to show that, yes, this is what we think of as standard English, but we didn't just wake up one day and it was standard English. There were powers that deemed it to be that way. There was colonialism. There was slavery. So we have a history behind the fact that this became what we think of as the standard in America. So I like to call it standardized English. So then on our right, we have incorrect English, improper English, non-standard American English, non-academic English, non-mainstream American English, informal English, home English, vernacular, dialect, language variation, or language variety. So oftentimes we think of those last three as the same thing, but there are terms that are a bit more favorable and less offensive, because even when we call it vernacular, so if you look up the definition of vernacular in Merriam-Webster, it says that it's a language or dialect native to a region or country rather than a literary, cultured, or foreign language. So it's basically stating that a vernacular is not cultured, it's not literary, which we know is not necessarily true. So think about African-American English. A lot of people call it African-American vernacular English, but that's sort of moving out of favor because we have learned that because it is a grammatical rule-governed language variety, then it's not just the vernacular. It's not something that's not cultured. It's quite the opposite of that. So we're moving more toward language variety or language variation. Even the word dialect is still used, and you'll hear me say dialect quite often because throughout my PhD program, we called it dialect. But now the field is moving more toward language variety because even dialect still has a bit of a negative connotation to it, because a lot of people, when they think of dialect, they think of something less than or a substandard language. So moving along, I also want to mention that when we think of these language varieties, we're not talking about slang. I'm happy to say, because aging is, you know, a right that is not given to all. Aging is a gift that's not given to all. So I'm happy to say that I'm at an age now that when there's a popular saying or I think I'm saying slang, more than likely young people have moved away from it. Once it's gotten to me, my nephews and my younger cousins, they probably laugh because they're not saying that anymore. When you think of a language variety, we're not talking about slang. Language varieties extend several years. Slang is something that's transient. It changes. But language varieties, the African-American English that I speak is the same African-American English that my grandmother speaks. Mm-hmm. But the slang that my nephew and my younger cousins use is not the same language variety that I use or that my grandmother uses. So it's not just slang. And actually, a language variety is a neutral label that refers to any variety of a language that is shared by a group of speakers. So when you think about it, thinking about that last slide, standardized American English is itself a language variety. It just happens to be the language variety that's associated with power in our country.
Brandy, oh my gosh, you just gave us so much amazing information. And I just love the connection that you just made with speaking African American English, the same English as your grandmother, and slang moving in and out. Of course, the same thing. I speak the same English as my daughter, but she, who is 16 years old, has the slang overlay that she uses words that I don't know. So that analogy is so perfect to being able, because I was going to say, well, tell us more about the difference, but you really gave us a beautiful analogy. I also want to just talk about for a second, like one of the authors that I know and am familiar with is Zora Neale Hurston. And I know that she uplifted and really wanted to uplift the language variety of her right. community in books. And it's just now, I think, really getting to be more mainstream for people to accept and read back to that literary part. It, mm-hmm. There is a literary and cultured part of this right. language variety that is, you know, needs to be uplifted and seen more often. Thank you right. for that.
Thank you.
Okay, so are we going to the next question? So now that we've talked about the language varieties, we've talked about, and we're going to use that terminology to the best of our ability for the rest of the, of the webinar. So tell us now about how that relates and affects reading acquisition.
Sure. Okay, so from years of research, we know that, I can't move that slide. Can you help me out, Maya?
Yes, absolutely.
So from years of research, we know, and then I put on the slide dialect, but it's okay, forgive me. We know from years and years of research and from meta-analyses that children who enter school with strong oral language skills tend to have less difficulty learning to read and write. So those children who are learning to read, when they have that strong oral language, they're able better than other kids who don't have strong oral language to map those words onto print. So that's when they're in the learning to read stage. And then there's also a significant relationship between oral language and literacy for those children who are in their reading to learn stage. So you think about those models of reading that we all know about, the simple model. And you think about the product of word decoding and language comprehension, and you get reading comprehension. And then you also think about Scarborough's ropes, where you have those components of word decoding and those components of language comprehension that all work together and they mesh to create reading comprehension. So when you have differences in your pronunciation or the way that you say things, it's going to affect you when you're learning to read. So we've learned that, and through a meta-analysis that I actually did myself, I found that there's actually a moderate and negative relationship between the use of language varieties or the production of language varieties other than standardized American English, because remember that standardized American English is a language variety itself, and reading and different literacy outcomes like spelling and writing. But I want to caution that because, yes, there is a negative relationship, which means that the more dialect a child produces in their spoken or written language, the lower their literacy scores tend to be. I want to caution that we can't say that correlation equals causation. We can't say that the dialect or the language variety is the cause of their lower literacy performance.
I just was going to say, I mean, that makes me think so much about multilingual learners and someone who speaks right. a language. We know the same thing is true, that first mm-hmm. of all, oral language is key to their being able to learn how to read. And right. the more time invested there, the return that we're going to get with their reading and writing. Mm-hmm. And we also know that the foreign language is not an inhibitor to learning the next language. Right. And I feel the same thing is true here. The English language variety that a student speaks is not going to be an inhibitor to learning right. the variety of school. It's in right. fact something that can be used to help them learn. And then they get two languages. So they have more exactly. than one variety, and we can mm-hmm. give it that same importance.
Right. And we've learned so much from the research that's been done on multilingual learners, because there are a lot of parallels between, and I'll talk about it a little bit more later, between our multilingual learners and our multilectal learners, those children who have more than one language variety. We've learned so much from the work that has been done. So thank you again to people like Elsa and to Claude, who have put in all of this work and this research that they've done. We've learned a lot from them. So getting more into that complicated relationship, because again, it's not that language variety causes lower literacy performance. We have some different theories that have that scholars have done research on, and they're realizing that there's not just one single factor out there. So the first of all, there's linguistic bias. So we know that there are certain language varieties like African-American English, like Chicano English, like Appalachian English, that are socially disfavored. there's a stigma behind them. And a lot of times when we hear people speak, we have this implicit bias or this inherent bias of what we think about them once we hear them speak. And African-American English and those other dialects that I named a lot of times are socially disfavored. So when we have this bias against those particular dialects or language varieties, we might think that those people who speak them are less capable. And as teachers, if we think this, then those expectations aren't very high. So we know the research on teacher expectations and student outcomes. So that linguistic bias actually indirectly determines student performance. And that's just one theory. Then there's also linguistic mismatch. And this is something that this research has been done for quite a while now. They've looked at the fact that, for instance, the way that a child speaks. So if a child says the word, I'm going to take a bath. So they think that BAF is how they, you know, symbolize that word that they use. They think it's spelled BAF. So when they come across the word BATH, that might be a foreign concept to them. So thinking about that mapping words onto print, there's that linguistic mismatch, and that happens over and over again in a sentence and then in paragraphs. There might be confusion there. And then also linguistic flexibility. So this actually deals with this idea of code shifting and code switching, and those students that are able to code switch have this linguistic flexibility, and their metalinguistic awareness is higher than those students who don't show that ability. So we haven't proven any one of these hypotheses or theories to be true, but we think that it could be a combination of all of them. Mm-hmm. But when you add in these other factors, I'm having trouble here. Okay, there we go. When you add in all of these other factors like institutionalized racism, political strife, insufficient and inadequate school resources and instructional quality, concentrated neighborhood and school poverty, in addition to all of those other things that are happening, then we see the reason that there might be students who speak with these disfavored language varieties are having difficulty with their reading achievement and their other literacy achievement, like spelling and writing. So it's not just one simple thing. It isn't just, well, they speak a dialect, so that's why they can't read. It's a very complex relationship.
Yes, I appreciate you outlining this complex relationship. And I feel that this complex relationship is absolutely applicable for multilingual learners as well, especially mm-hmm. depending on what their heritage language is, right. Because we know that some heritage languages are seen to be more valuable than others. Mm-hmm. And then when we're with the languages that seem to be, you know, less valued, all of these right. things come into play there as well. One thing I talk about a lot, and I feel like you've surfaced it here, is this concept of learning English has been portrayed to us for a long time as an intervention activity. And mm-hmm. I talk about that in terms of like state dollars, federal dollars have been earmarked in such a way. I do think that the intention with that is good. It has us focus on making sure that everyone has the opportunity, and I can appreciate right. that. But on the other side of it, we get this where one language or one variety of English is deemed the most superior, mm-hmm. and the other languages, either varieties or actual foreign languages, are seen either less than or they're as a barrier. And so I right. love that you're showing us this, because it means so much in all of our ways that we are attending to our language diverse classrooms. Thank mm-hmm. you. That's amazing.
Right. And I love that you bring that up, because I think that we often think of our multilingual learners as being in one box, our multilectal learners as being in another box, and then our standardized English speakers as being in another box. We also have to remember that our students don't always fit neatly into these boxes. Many of our multilingual learners are learning African-American English or Appalachian English, depending on what area of the world that they live in. A lot of them actually live in neighborhoods where there are a lot of other African-American children. So they're picking up on AAE as well. And we kind of just talk about them like they're separate. Mm-hmm. And that's not necessarily the case. And even another point I wanted to make is that I speak AAE. And that's oftentimes a surprise to people, especially when I'm only around them at work. Mm-hmm. But I speak AAE in different environments. Just because I don't speak it when I'm working or because I'm not speaking it right now doesn't mean that I'm not an AAE speaker. So that's one thing that we also have to keep in mind as well.
I love that, Brandy. And, you know, having experience with code switching, I think is something that's really, for me, it's something that, again, same thing, like people don't always know. And it's something that because I'm Mexican American and I have these other ways of being and experiencing life, I think that it's just important for us to be thinking about the lived experiences of other people and just being curious about it. We can't know everything about everyone else, but right. being open and curious about it, I think is what's key. And the other thing I just want to land on for a moment is that I love that you brought in the research from multilingual learners, from applied mm-hmm. linguistics, and you're attaching it to partly your lived experience and then also right. opening up doors. But so it's something that Elsa talks about is we're professionals. And so we have this right. opportunity to bring in the knowledge and not have it separate and siloed, but really open it up so that we all get to learn together. I just love that
right.
so much.
Right. Yeah. Awesome. I just want to say that before we talk about this, you know, a lot of times, because I have my PhD, a lot of times people think, you know, the PhD is the end all be all. Now you're the expert on this topic. But I got my PhD in 2015 and I have learned way more than I've learned way more in those, 9 years than while I was in my PhD program. Of course, it gives you the tools and, you know, the methods, the statistics that you need to use to be able to analyze data. But in working with teachers and actually being out in schools, you know, I was a teacher for 7 years, so I get it. A lot of times there is that, and I'm going to talk about this more, but a lot of times there is like this divide, this unspoken divide between researcher and practitioner, where the teachers and the administrators. And yeah, I'm going to save that for later, but we can get right into question three. But I just wanted to mention that, you know, I am always open to learning more. The more you learn, the more you realize that you don't know. And so I'm never afraid to say, I don't know, because I don't know it all. I do have a PhD that says a lot I know, but I don't know everything.
Thank you, Brandy. Oh my gosh, amazing. So moving on to question three. So we're talking about language, we're talking about language variety, and then in that conversation, nestled in is this concept of accent. And so I think that this is going to be super interesting. So just tell us more about the accent and I'll move the slide along for us.
Yeah. So if you think of like just a spectrum, and we talk about an accent versus a language variety or dialect. If you think about the spectrum, you have accent on one end, and then you have language on another end. Somewhere in the middle is a dialect or language variety. So at least that stands for most languages. Now, when we talk about Chinese languages, now again, I don't know everything, so someone can definitely correct me if I'm wrong, but I do know that Cantonese and Mandarin are considered dialects, but they're very different from one another. But in most cases, when we talk about a dialect or language variety, they actually have a lot in common with other language varieties within that same language. So even African American English or Southern American English, which overlap a lot because of the history of our country, they overlap more than they're different with standardized American English. There are just differences here and there. It's not a completely different language, but there's still a lot of overlap. So somewhere in between accent and language are language varieties and dialects. Accents have more to do with pronunciation and the different ways that we say different words. When you talk about a language variety, they're systematic, they're rule governed, they're valid. but their features cross all domains of language. So first, there is phonology. So there are differences in the way that words are pronounced. So like I said, bath versus bath. That TH at the end a lot of times is pronounced differently. Morphology. The morphemes are often left off of the end of words in certain language varieties. Syntax. You think about the grammar that we use. There are certain words that aren't necessarily used, like we call them helping verbs. A lot of times helping verbs aren't used in certain language varieties, especially in African-American English. And then also in the semantic domain, word meanings often have different vocabulary within different language varieties. Words have different meanings. And then think about pragmatics, the why, the how, the who, the what, the when. Who you're speaking to determines how you say things a lot of times. I am from Tennessee, but I've also lived in just outside of Miami in Pembroke Pines. I saw there was someone here from Miami, but I lived in Pembroke Pines, Florida. I lived in Tallahassee, Florida. I lived in Atlanta, Georgia. I've lived in California. And in different places, I'm expected to say yes, ma'am, no, ma'am. When I was in Tennessee, when I grew up, that's just how it was. But if I go to Miami, which is geographically in the South, but it is not Southern at all. And when I go to California, if I say yes, ma'am, no, ma'am, they're offended by that. So you have to, you know, different situations call for different language varieties and different uses of language. So language varieties, the big difference between an accent and a language variety is that it crosses all domains of language, not just pronunciation or phonology.
I love that. I love that. And we were talking earlier about like this nuance of accent and pronunciation, especially when it comes to reading. And
right.
This, you know, this idea that an accent is not to be corrected. You know, the mm-hmm. world, there's billions of English speakers in the entire world, and every single one of them speak with their own accent,
right.
Especially if they have a heritage language or their language variety and they're speaking the standard English. Pronunciation is something that's a little different that we
right.
may or may not correct if it's impeding our ability to comprehend what someone is saying. So
right.
I just learned that you made that distinction here too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and even just thinking about the word correcting, like just, I don't like to use the word correcting, but I do like the point that you bring up that it's something that we need to talk about. You know, I always talk about this example of, you know, me being from Tennessee. When I moved to Florida, I actually had the honor of taking a class with Joe Torgerson. And on one of the first days, I'm a freshman in my freshman seminar class with this distinguished professor. And he holds this up and he says, "Brandy, what's this?" And I say, "It's a pen." Because, of course, I'm from Tennessee. That's how we say it. And he pointed out that the way that I pronounced it is probably the reason that, you know, a lot of kids will have difficulty with the short E and the short I, because in certain places, and if you're watching this from the South, you know that they're pronounced probably exactly the same. Even my teachers pronounced them exactly the same. So I knew that I had a lot of difficulty. And when he embarrassed me a little bit in front of the class, but now I'm not embarrassed at all. But when he pointed that out, it turned the light bulb on for me. And it said, wow, the way that we pronounce things really does make a difference when we're learning to read. So just pointing out those differences and being able to talk about those differences is just really important.
Yes, I love that. So it's not necessarily correcting, it's just pointing
right.
out differences. It's a completely possible for someone to
exactly.
learn the differences. And it's not, as we said, an intervention activity. It's just a noticing
right.
activity.
Right.
It's an opportunity to notice something new and different.
Exactly.
I love that. I love
exactly.
that. Yeah. Well, this is great. This actually leads us right into which is, you know, how can we shift our mindset to embrace language diversity as the true asset that it is? And I know you're going to go into it, and I would love for you to talk a little bit more about how especially African-American English is full, complete, ruled by grammar. It's its own beautiful entity. I think some people are still wondering about that, and I would love for you to just uplift it.
Yeah, of course. So I would say that we, you know what, before I even get into that slide, I'm going to go back to the other one because I really want to address what you said about African-American language. And there are debates on even what to call African-American English, because some people from the linguistic side, a lot of people call it African-American language or Black language, just to show that it is very unique. And a lot of times people do want to just set it apart from what we often refer to as standardized American English. And like I said, I'm an African American English speaker. That's my native language. That's the language that I use with my family. And if you have ever tried to speak African American English and you're not a native speaker, then you may realize that, oh, it actually really is complex. You know, you may hear stereotypical instances when people try to speak African American English and they get it wrong because they don't understand it completely and they don't realize that it is rule based. Mm-hmm. And unless you have actually been entrenched in that culture and been around it, a lot of times you don't really know the rules. And it's, you know, it's not something that a lot of people feel comfortable talking about or feel comfortable addressing, especially when you're not from that culture. So I know I completely understand, those of you watching this, that if you're not from that culture, how am I supposed to talk about that? How am I supposed to address that? But there are different resources that tell you about the features of African American English, and there are is professional development that you can do. And then there's also a resource within your own schools, your speech language pathologists. Speech language pathologists are actually required to learn about dialects and linguistic diversity because they're the ones who have to diagnose our children with speech impairments or language disorders. So they need to know about disorders versus differences. So that's a really good resource to have within the school. But again, like you said, Mayan, I really appreciate that African-American English, for one, just like any other language variety, is rule-based. And it is not just ungrammatical or just random errors or just people trying to speak correct English. It actually is its own kind of language system, and it's very complex.
I love that. Thank you so much for that explanation. And then I think that leads us right into a perfect way to talk about this asset that the students are bringing. One thing that I talk a lot about when, you know, it's really identifying the asset that the student is bringing, understanding that they have a full complex foundation of language, if it's a foreign language or if it's in a language variety, and all of that helps them learn this new language. And just to land on for a second, you also talked about, you know, the teacher getting to know the nuances and some of the features of the language. Elsa talked about that as well. Oftentimes I hear teachers say, you know, I can't know every single language of my students. And that's true. You're not expected to know the entirety of the language. But as a professional, it's great for you to know nuances and features so that you can help make those connections to the language that you're speaking. Because we're all language as we've learned.
Exactly. And one thing that I wanted to bring up is that, you know, the if you are teaching in schools where 90% of your students are Black or African American, you are doing a disservice to your students if you don't learn more about African American English, especially if those students are African American English speakers, which more than likely, if you're at a school with 90% African-American children, then they're going to be African-American English speaking students, even if they are not in your presence, because a lot of times children have been taught at home to code switch. So sometimes you have children who are AAE speakers, but they may not always use their language variety. But that's another, we could talk about that. Oh, that could be a whole nother presentation, but I do want to just get into just thinking about language diversity as an asset, just like we think about being bilingual. I actually have my daughter enrolled in a bilingual, she's two, so I don't like to call it daycare, but it's not quite preschool yet, but she's enrolled in a bilingual school because I want to empower her to be able to use Spanish in different environments when she needs it. I wish that I could speak Spanish fluently. I know a few words here and there because I lived in Miami, so I didn't really have a choice sometimes, but I know a few words here and there, but I feel like I'm empowering her by putting her in a school where she's going to be immersed in Spanish. And so she's actually going to have something that I didn't have. But 50 years ago, if you ask someone, would you pay for your child to go to school to be bilingual? No, mm-hmm. It was looked at as something that was bad. It was confusing. It was, you know, they need to learn English. But now we know, due to research and neurocognitive research, we know that language diversity is actually an asset. And we know that dialect itself is not necessarily a risk factor. We need to just encourage metalinguistic awareness, and we can do that through structured literacy and the science of reading. Language variation, through work that Julie Washington has done, we know that language variation is actually associated with complex language structure. So children who enter school speaking different language varieties actually have very complex speech patterns, but oftentimes the way that we assess them through our standardized assessments, they don't capture those strengths. So we have to start thinking about how can we use those language variations and that complex language structure to our advantage in the classrooms. Mm-hmm. And it's also important for teachers to be aware of language variation and how dialect can inform high quality instruction for students. So when we think about those components of reading instruction, those five pillars that we all know, phonics, phonological awareness, vocabulary, fluency, and comprehension. So not just thinking about reading comprehension as a whole, but thinking about those different component skills and how language diversity affects each one of those component skills. And for instance, especially when we're talking about assessments, for instance, if you think about phonological awareness, and one of the more common features of African-American English is leaving off a consonant blend or a final consonant sound. So if you have a child and you tell them, tell me the sounds in this word, show me this and tell me the sounds. So they may say, ah, because the way that they pronounce it is hen. So giving that explicit instruction and just pointing out, oh, there's a duh sound at the end, just pointing that out, not saying, no, you're saying it wrong, just pointing that out, just those subtle differences, and just knowing how language variation affects those individual components of reading instruction.
Excellent.
Right after that. Yeah, and I was just going to give this quote. This was Julie Washington and Mark Seidenberg, and they said that speaking, I put a diverse language variety, but in the actual paper, they said speaking African-American English is not inherently an obstacle to becoming a reader, but it becomes one when children's specific needs are not recognized or addressed. And we know this is very similar to multilingual learning. Multilingual learning is not inherently, or speaking a different language is not inherently an obstacle, but it becomes one when children's specific needs are not recognized or addressed. We also know from research that previous coursework on African-American English actually predicts teachers' overall linguistic knowledge. So knowing about morphology, syntax, morphosyntactic features of African-American English, just taking some coursework or learning about those different features actually can improve your overall linguistic knowledge. And then also familiarizing classroom teachers with features of African-American English actually results in increased knowledge and positive attitudes towards AAE. So we can actually address that linguistic bias when we teach more about African-American English and how complex the language is. So we can at least address one of those tenets, that linguistic bias, by familiarizing classroom teachers with what exactly the language varieties are.
Fantastic. This is so great. It goes to, we're going to have this slide, but it's like the more you know, the easier it is for you to understand what your students are doing, and the more you can appreciate what they're doing.
Exactly.
And the more you appreciate what they're doing, that changes the context with which you're delivering instruction.
Right, exactly.
This is just so great. And I love how you put the diverse language variety in brackets, because yes, I mean, that same exact quote can be used for foreign language. Definitely.
Right.
Okay, this is great. So carrying on, you have more to tell us.
Yeah, so this kind of goes back to what I just said. A first step is recognizing your own implicit biases and learning more about language varieties. So a lot of times, I say this all the time, you don't know what you don't know. Mm-hmm. But if you knew better, you would do better. So a lot of times, just taking a step back and just learning about these language varieties and what exactly they are, so that you can actually, if you're looking at a child's writing sample, you can actually distinguish actual mm-hmm. errors mm-hmm. from their language diversity. And then thinking about the multilingual world, how much we've learned about the cognitive benefits that being multilingual has, they can also extend to multilectal children. Of course, we don't have as much research as the multilingual world, but we're learning so much still. And we also want to advocate for more grant funding to go to research that goes to multilectal students. And then also just strengthening metalinguistic awareness through structured literacy and through talking about language and just having explicit conversations about language variety. Again, I know this isn't necessarily easy, because it is. Trust me, I know I researched this. I know that it's a controversial topic. I know about the Oakland, Ebonics debate that happened about 30 years ago. I know that many times in the professional development that I do, a lot of times Black educators are the ones who give the most hesitance to actually accept African-American English in their classrooms. But that is a result of it being ingrained in them that they can't use African-American English. They were brought up to just similar to what you and Elsa were talking about, you get the hand slap because you were speaking Spanish. You might've gotten a hand slap because you said ain't.
Mm-hmm.
So because it's been ingrained in them, a lot of times, no, African-American English is not gonna be used in my classroom. So I know that this is a very controversial topic, but we do need to just start having these hard conversations. I mean, the same way that, I hate to even bring it up, but the same way that the murder of George Floyd forced us to have conversations about racism and institutionalized racism and our biases, we don't need another event like that to force us to have these conversations. We just need to just start having these uncomfortable conversations. And I think that today is a start.
And the thing is, having these conversations become more comfortable once you just start. It's
right.
Almost the fear of having the conversation is more scary than actually just getting into the conversation.
Right.
And,
exactly.
And bringing your professional knowledge to the conversation, being open and being curious, taking, the time for deep breaths and, the same thing. It's controversial. Multilingual learners and structured literacy.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of controversy there, too. So it's, there's bringing the asset orientation, bringing a sense of calm, bringing a sense of openness, bringing mm-hmm. those abilities to this conversation. It doesn't have to be so controversial. It could be exciting, actually,
right.
Especially
right.
with all the research that's going on, like you said, the brain research. And, it is exciting because other human beings are exciting. They're interesting.
Exactly.
It's like seeing it from that perspective. So that helps us move on actually to the next question, which is help us, get more excited about this. Help
mm-hmm.
us think about, ways that we can get excited, that we can use language in a new way to think about our students, talk about our students, and just approach these conversations. So I'll move us on to the next slide.
Yeah, definitely. So I just want to say that, how can we, what are the next steps? So what I really want you to take from this is that words matter. And you know, the words that we would normally use to refer to what I call language varieties or diverse language varieties, think about the message, the traditional words that we normally use as educators, because, you know, as educators, we're prescriptive. Our job is to try to fix things and to try to prepare our students for the world outside of school once they graduate. But we use words like incorrect or improper, non-standard, non-academic, non-mainstream. What message are we sending to our students when we use those words? And what are we telling them about their community? What are we telling them about the way their mother speaks or their uncle speaks or their grandmother? So do they go home and think, oh, wow, my grandmother speaks incorrectly. Mm-hmm. But how is it incorrect when she's expressing herself? It may not be the standardized way or the way that politicians speak or the way that news anchors speak, but there's nothing incorrect about the way that they're speaking. So just think about the words that you use going forward. And then also, you know, you and Elsa brought up Proposition 227 in California that banned foreign languages in the classroom. So when we think about it, when we ban a language, and I put here a language variety, because a lot of times inherently we are banning language varieties in our classroom when we tell students not to use certain words or to speak a certain way. When we ban those language varieties, we're actually doing so much more than that. So think about what Proposition 227 in California actually did to generations of children who are now adults. They weren't able to communicate with grandparents because they couldn't learn the language that was their heritage language. They weren't able to communicate with family members in other countries. And then it also gave the children power because a lot of times they would have to translate for their own parents. So think about the dynamic that happens there. When you might be sitting in a parent-teacher conference and you have to speak to the child who then speaks to the parent because they have to translate because you have basically created this wall because you've banned this language. So think about language varieties. When you ban language varieties, you're telling children that the way that you're communicating with your family members is wrong. Mm-hmm. And then it also creates kind of this divide between family members, because if you think about it, if I weren't a code switcher or a code shifter or a dialect shifter or whatever language that you choose to describe it, I wouldn't be able to really communicate with my grandmother. I really wouldn't really be able to communicate with different family members who didn't necessarily go to college or leave Tennessee. Mm-hmm. So they didn't have as much exposure to standardized English that I have, but I'm proud to be a dialect shifter. And then also just language has power. The words that we use have so much power. And just being careful about what we say and how we say it, but just being able to have those open, honest, and hard conversations is just so important.
Thank you so much. Well, that is going to lead us to a slide with references that everyone in the audience will know you have access to this. So if you want to look up any of the resources that Brandy's talked about, you will have access to that. And then just ending on this last slide that Elsa happened to put in the series earlier this week, and it says, it's the knowledgeable professional implementing evidence-based practices who will have the greatest positive impact upon their students. So first of all, everybody on this webinar, thank you so much, because you are that knowledgeable professional who is searching out and seeking those evidence-based practices. So we know that exponentially today, you are going to have that positive impact on their students. And so I just want to take this moment, Brandy, just to ask you about your why and what brought you to this work, and you know, what is it that tugs on your heart to bring you here to this work?
So I mentioned her briefly, but I have a grandmother who is, if it's the Lord's will, as she says, she will be 102 on March 10th. And I also have a daughter who is 2. So seeing them communicate just makes it so important to me. And just knowing that if they weren't able to actually have conversations and communicate, how much that would, I would feel like I was robbing I would feel like I was robbing her and myself and the rest of my family of those memories. So just thinking about my grandmother and everything that she has seen, she was born in 1922. Mm-hmm. And she's lived in Tennessee most of her life. So being a Black woman in the South and thinking about everything that she's gone through and everything that she's seen, and just respecting and valuing the language that she uses. She's not someone, you know, she didn't graduate from high school. She helped raise a dozen siblings. I won't even say how many she has. She has a lot of siblings, but she helped raise this whole family. And just having this great respect for her and thinking about, if we teach students that the way that they speak is incorrect, you're teaching them that the way my grandmother speaks is incorrect. And there's nothing incorrect about the way she speaks. So I have just so much respect for her. And just, I want my daughter to continue that heritage. And I don't want her to ever think that there's something wrong with African-American English. And I don't want to ever pass that message on to her. I just want to give her the power to be able to use whatever language variety or whatever language that she chooses to use in whatever situation that she thinks is appropriate.
Amazing. I love that so, so much.
Thank you. Yeah,
that's beautiful. And you've already kind of referenced my story because you know it. So, you know, my grandmother was, she did get the paddle at school and was told to stop speaking Spanish. And that trauma was passed down through the ages. So I love that you are, you know, your passion. We have a similar reason for being where we are. And I really appreciate that. So I'm going to just take a moment just to talk about how we're bringing our point of view to an online language and literacy academy. So at CORE, we are working on a professional learning academy in structured literacy. So all the things in terms of the reading rope and evidence-based research practices that Brandy talked about, and specifically for the language diverse classroom. We know that our classrooms are full of students who speak another language besides English. Elsa says, you know, they're coming English as an additional language. I love that. I've adopted it. It's in my speech now. And we know that students speak a variety of English. They're coming to school to learn standardized English. And all of this can be done. It's great. It's not an intervention. It can be done in a healthy, positive, affirming, asset-oriented way. And that is our goal with Hola, which we are offer to you. So if there, I know there's a poll coming up somewhere. If you would like more information about our online academy, you can answer this poll and we'd be happy to. And then I'm going to open it up for questions. So I'll call Christy back on and she can start us with our questions.
Wow. There's so much love in the chat. So if you have a chance, read through. Melody said, I love this. Need a couple more webinars for a deep dive on certain points. So we need a few more. Melody, actually check out Hola. We are bringing in a lot of what Brandy spoke about today to help teachers learn this and use it in their classroom. So definitely take a peek at the new product coming out. Okay, there's a lot of questions. I know we only have 5 minutes. So here we go. And I had to like number them because there's so many. Okay. From Tara, how do you help teachers balance between embracing students' heritage language and holding them accountable for Standard American English? Since Standard American English is the language that is used for state and school assessments, and this data is often used as a reflection of the teacher.
That's a very good question. And the, you know, in a perfect world, we would just allow our students to write in the language that is most comfortable for them. And because again, standardized English is the language of power in our country, and also, you know, other countries use, you know, they, if you talk to a family in Japan, oh, my child is going to learn English because they need to be able to learn English because they're going to be an international business person. So yes, we want to respect those heritage languages. I think a big start is just using the terminology that I talked about, not using words like incorrect improper inappropriate, and maybe even have exercises where you allow students to write in the language that they're comfortable with, and having conversations about code shifting, dialect shifting, code meshing, and that's a workshop that I could do. Code meshing, translanguaging, and that's where you actually use parts of both language varieties, and you actually can write. Like, think about, you brought up Zora Neale Hurston. If you pick up Their Eyes Were Watching God, she used both standardized English and like a Southern African American English, because I think the story was in Florida, right?
Yes.
So she used a Southern African American English throughout the book. She switched back and forth. So it's not that students have to stick to using one or choose one or another at all times. I think that we have to empower our students to be able to use standardized English when they feel like it's appropriate. But, you know, a really hard part is the fact that they are going to be graded by some other person who may not even have training on African American English or this linguistic diversity. So it is, that's one thing that I'm working on. I want those standardized assessment raters to actually be able to know dialect when they see it, so they can pick up the paper and say, oh, this student is actually telling a really interesting story. They're not just making grammatical errors. So I think that it's a way that we can actually make our writing more interesting by using components of both.
Love it. Charity voted for code meshing. Please give that workshop.
I'll make myself a note. We'll talk about that later.
From Brooke, the main strategy to allow students to spell words is to say, sound it out. Knowing the accent varieties and language varieties can make reading and spelling challenging. How do teachers pose a response that's not sounded out that can lead to the wrong spelling of a word?
Yeah, that's tough, because if you think about it, this is not just dialect speakers. Think about the words enough, through, cough, and though. All of those, the end of the words are O-U-G-H. They're spelled exactly the same, but they each have different pronunciations. So even when we tell a standardized American English speaker to sound it out, that's not going to necessarily always be the case. I think that, you know, I can't remember if it was Claude's presentation or Elsa's presentation. They said, you know, literacy impacts language, language impacts literacy, or something like that. But the more a child reads and is exposed to language, then the more that they understand how that structured literacy works, and the more that they will see those patterns in the spelling, and it actually will help their spelling skills when they are a more proficient reader. So just encouraging reading, and not necessarily just saying sound it out, because that's not even always the case for standardized American English speakers.
Absolutely. And just to add on to that, it's okay to give explicit instruction in those examples that you just gave, Brandy, of those spellings, and to show a person, this is how it's right. spelled. Sometimes it's pronounced like this, mm-hmm. and like this. So,
exactly. You
know, effective instructional practices work. Sound it out is not necessarily, it's not an effective instructional practice. Mm-hmm. What is explicit direct instruction in how the right. sound and spelling work in the standardized English. So yeah.
Right. Or even like the example that I gave with the word hand, I might not pronounce the word the way that it's spelled. So just you pronouncing it with me, and maybe even having a conversation about, you know, sometimes we might say it when we're talking quickly, or if we're talking to our friends, we might just say hand. But if you think about it, it's actually hand. So there's a sound at the end that we don't always say. Mm-hmm. And so I bring that up all the time, that, you know, we're all dialect speakers, but, you know, when we're talking to our friends, most of us aren't speaking the exact same way when you're given a presentation.
I mean, you can think of the word like going. Most of us don't pronounce going all right. the way. Or oftentimes in reading, we also have to highlight the and the schwa and and, you know, I mean, this happens all the time. It's not some kind of foreign right. concept. We do this right. already in reading, but it's the uplifting, like you said, Brandy, of the language variety and giving it the importance that, oh, we're going to do it here too, because you speak right. a full complete language and I'm showing you this other language.
Right, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The chat's fun. People are giving like other examples. It's really fun. Our time is up. Thank you for those of you that stayed 1 minute past. This was so special. Thank you, Brandy and Maya.
Thank you to everybody. I'm looking at the chat now. Thank you so much for the positive comments. Like I said, this isn't something that's easy to talk about. You all, the teachers, the ones who are actually in the field, I have the utmost respect for you. So I'm definitely open to partnerships and doing research in the school. So keep me in mind.
Oh, we love that. We love that. Thank you, educators, for joining us. Have a wonderful rest of your day and rest of the week. Thank you, everyone. Bye.
We hope you enjoyed this EdWeb podcast. If you'd like to receive a CE certificate, you must watch the video recording. Recordings and quizzes can be found in the EdWebinar archives. Please visit home.edweb.net/podcasts for more information.